All right, thanks very much. It's great to be here. This is my first lecture of the new academic year. The last lecture I gave was in May in Merriam-Mackillop College, so I haven't spoken publicly all summer, unless you count speaking to my family as public speaking. So this is going to be my warm-up lecture for the semester ahead. Our semester starts on Monday. Okay, so this is me just warming myself up for it, all right? So you can take it easy on me, it's okay. Right, so I'm here to talk about the existence of God. Jason gave me a nice, title for the paper, God, Big Bang, Evolution. We're going to talk about all those things, and the paper that I'm giving tonight kind of covers the material out of both my books with Oxford University Press. So it covers issues pertaining to Aquinas' thinking on the existence of God, particularly how to demonstrate the existence of God and what that entails for creation, what Aquinas' views on creation are. Okay, so let's get into it. When we think about the question of God, okay, we're thinking about the whole issue of God. And when we talk about God, we usually, use the terms such as faith, reason, all that sort of thing. But one very peculiar thing about St. Thomas Aquinas and a lot of the medieval philosophers and theologians, as well as just the Christian tradition of thought in general in this regard, is that you need to have definite proof for the existence of God. Okay, it is possible to have proof for the existence of God, and if one is so intellectually inclined, one ought to give proof for the existence of God. God's existence is not an article of faith. Okay, it's not there in any one of the articles of faith within the creed the Christians profess. So God's existence isn't an article of faith. God's existence is presupposed, it's assumed for the articles of faith. So when somebody repeats the profession of faith, say if you're Catholic and you repeat the creed during Mass, you're presupposing the existence of God, obviously, because why else would you be at Mass professing your faith? So faith is something that builds on the presupposed existence of God. God's existence is known as a preamble to faith. It's something that needs to be there in order for faith to occur. So God's existence has to be known before one has faith. And if one is philosophically and intellectually inclined, as Aquinas and others were, one can offer philosophical demonstrations for that. So that's what Aquinas' attitude is for demonstrating the existence of God. He was a man of faith, he's a priest, he's a saint, he was a Dominican. But he was also, a deep thinker, a heavy philosopher. He wrote stuff, really difficult to come to terms with. And he offers these demonstrations for God's existence because he thinks they can be offered and that we ought to offer them. So, how do we get into this? How do we go about doing this? Well, one of the most popular ways, and what I think is the backbone of Aquinas' ways of demonstrating the existence of God, is through consideration of cause and effect, very specifically through consideration of the nature of causality. If any of you have studied any St. Thomas Aquinas before, you'll know that he has the very famous five ways in the Summa Theologiae. All of them, I think at least, and I know this is being recorded, so if anybody in the podcast hears this, I think at least all of them are based on cause-effect, reasoning in a certain way. I'm working on a third book, which goes through them to try and see how cause and effect forms the backbone of them. But throughout Thomas's writings where you find these demonstrations on the existence of God, there's always this implicit appeal to causality. And so we're going to go through that in this lecture, and we're going to see what he has to say about cause and effect and the different sort of causal series. Now, a very basic truth that Thomas holds about the relationship between cause and effect is that an effect depends on its cause. There's a dependency relation there between cause and effect. If you didn't have the cause, you would not have the effect. So the effect comes from its cause in some sort of way. It's derived from it. That's where the dependency relationship is set up. It's through the derivation. So given an effect, if you see some sort of an effect, you can infer a cause. It doesn't work the other way around. It doesn't mean because you have a cause, you can infer an effect. But if you have an effect, you can infer a cause. Now, it's tricky to establish what exactly an effect is, and we're going to be getting into that in this lecture. But suffice to say, given that an effect is derived from a cause, we can move from effect to cause, according to St. Thomas. And this is because the effect is lacking in something that the cause provides. There's something about the effect that if there were no cause, the effect would be incomplete in some sort of way, or there just wouldn't be an effect. The classic example in this regard is this one here, the motion of the snooker balls. The snooker balls in themselves are motionless. They don't have any motion. But then when the player hits the ball, he imparts motion to the ball. Okay, so the balls have their motion from the player. They would be lacking in that motion were it not for the player or some sort of other cause to give them motion. Okay, so they're incomplete in some sort of way. They're lacking in something without the activity of the cause. And that's really just what Thomas takes the relationship between cause and effect to be. So the dependency there, then, is one of derivation. All right. Now, on the basis of that, Thomas sets up different types of causal series. He outlines what he takes causal series to be. Does everybody know what this is? Yeah, we're all sort of nodding our heads. Anybody know what it's called?
Newton's cradle.
Newton's cradle. There you go. It took the doctor at the back there to tell us that. Okay. Right. So this is Newton's cradle. So everybody knows how a Newton's cradle works. You know, you pull one ball, you know, it hits the other ones, the motion goes right through, and then comes out the other end, okay, causes the ball to move. So what we have here with the Newton's cradle is a kind of causal series. The motion from this ball imparts motion to this one, and to the ultimate effect, and it moves. And that's basically how it works. So we have a causal series of A causing motion in B to C to D, and so on, and so on, until the thing comes to a natural end. Or if it's Newton's cradle, it goes back and forth, you know, until it wears out. Okay, so that's more or less what a causal series is. Each member is sort of derived from the previous member and gains its causality from the previous member. If we think back to snooker balls example, or pool, if anybody's played pool or snooker, you know that one ball can hit the other and can hit the other, and the motion can pass down the line. So that's how we set causal series up. We just observe that causality just proceeds down a particular series, and we have these different members which we can distinguish. So far, so good. But Thomas goes a wee bit deeper, okay? And the other medieval philosophers went a wee bit deeper. He distinguishes two types of causal series. So in all causal series, we have several members. Cause, effect, cause, effect, cause, effect, and so on. But Thomas distinguishes between two kinds. There are what are called accidental series, or in Latin, per accident series. And then, as we're going to see, there are what are called essentially ordered, or per se, series. And this is very important in St. Thomas's thinking, because it's on the basis of the distinction between these two kinds of series that Thomas argues one kind of series can be infinite. It can be without a primary cause, and that's this accidental series, so he holds that can be infinite. But another kind of series can't be infinite. There always has to be some sort of primary cause to it. Not a first cause, as we're going to see, but a primary cause, a foundational cause, that on which the members of the series depend. So we're going to have a look at the different features of these two series and see what St. Thomas has to say about them. So we'll start with this accidental series, or the per accident series. In this sort of series, you have a cause, a series of cause and effects, and they're only related to each other accidentally. Now, the classic example of this, the one that Thomas and others always use, is the relationship of a father to son. Okay, the son wouldn't exist without his father. Okay, so the father is the cause of his son in a very important way. So the son comes from his father. So the father begets his son, has a relationship of paternity or fatherhood to his son. But now, let's think that that son goes on and has his own son. So here's the three of them here, okay? This is the grandfather. That was our original father, okay? This was his son. He's all grown up now. And now he's had this one here. This is the grandson. This is this guy's son. So this was the original father. This was the son. And he's now had a son. We have a causal series now, okay? We have one leading to the other, leading to the other. And the question Thomas asks, he doesn't interrogate this series in asking this question. He sort of outlines the metaphysics of it, and then he says, well, look, you know, this applies to this kind of series. The question here is, who is the cause of the grandson? Who brought the grandson into existence? So this wee guy here, he's this guy's grandson. Who's his cause? Well, obviously the father brought him about. Okay, the grandson wouldn't be without his father. He's necessary. We need him in order for this guy to be. We also need the mother as well, obviously. But we need him to bring him about. But what about the grandfather? How does the grandfather fit in here? Now, Thomas in the medievals reasoned that the grandfather is the cause of the father, And the father is the cause of this son here, the grandson. But the grandfather is not the cause of the grandson. And here is why. Okay, people in the podcast will be thinking there's some serious images going up in this one. Right. This is why the grandfather isn't the cause of the grandson. Think about this. The father causes his son, okay? Let's imagine the father goes off celebrating. Have we ever heard of wetting the baby's head? Yeah? Okay. So is that a tradition here as well as in Belfast? Yeah. Okay. So the father, has his son, goes out and wets the baby's head. Tragically, he dies. All right? The son doesn't cease to exist. The son grows up, has his own child. That child is the original father's grandson. He's not a grandfather, but he's dead. He's deceased. He's gone. He died the day his son was born. Given that the grandfather is dead by the time that his grandson is begotten, he cannot be the cause of his grandson. He doesn't do anything to bring about his grandson. He does something to bring about his own son, who then goes off and has his own son, but he doesn't bring about the grandson. This is what Thomas and the other medievals observe, that the causality of the series it's not transitive. It doesn't pass down the series, and this distinguishes this sort of series from the next sort of series we're going to consider, where you need to have the earlier members in order to have the later members. In this sort of series, earlier members can sort of fall out, they can drop out of the series, but the series can continue on and on. So the series of fathers and sons and fathers and sons, that can continue further and further and further. And this is precisely because, getting a wee bit technical now, or more technical, this is because the members of this series, the members of the fathers and sons series, they have the causality of the series in themselves. Okay, they possess it in themselves in virtue of what they are. So the sort of causality we're talking about here is paternity or begetting or something like that. The men in this series, grandfather, father, son, they're able to beget or to have children in virtue of what they are, biologically functioning males of the human species. So they have the causality in themselves. So if an earlier member of the series drops out, that's okay, because each of the later members still possesses the causality of the series and can exercise that causality in the series. Now that's going to be distinct from the next sort of series that we consider, wherein the members don't possess the causality of themselves, and so they will depend on something earlier in the series in order to act as causes themselves, which means that we do need some sort of earlier member of the series for the later members to act, however many members of the later series there are. Now, just to anticipate a little bit, Thomas reasons that because in this accidental series you can take away earlier members and the series can continue, he holds that it's perfectly logical, it's not contradictory, to hold that that sort of series is without a beginning, without a primary cause. Because if you just take away a previous member, the series can go on. So just imagine to infinity, you just continually had these members of the series. You have a father, produces a son, the father dies, son produces a son, he dies, he produces a son, he dies, and it goes on and on and on. At any one point, it's actually finite. It's always going to be a finite series at any one point, but it is potentially infinite, given the succession of the members of the series. So Thomas holds, yeah, that's perfectly reasonable. It may be factually false, but there's nothing contradictory. There's nothing logically problematic about it. Okay? So it's not necessary to affirm that these accidental series are finite, because they could be infinite. Thomas grants that. Happy to. Okay. Right. We move on to this next sort of series, essential series. Now, the typical example which is used in the essentially ordered or the per se ordered series is the mind or the intentional agent or whatever you think causes intentional activity. Okay, whatever you think causes agency. That moves a hand to move a stick to move a stone. So that was always the classic example that Thomas uses. He uses that in the first way, or the second way, one of the first two ways, and in several other places. The mind causes the hand to move the stick to move the stone. I think this golf example here, you know, we're a bit more sanguine, you know, we can kind of think our way into it more. My brother-in-law is a professional golf player, okay? God bless my sister, she's a golf widow. but does anybody here play golf? Do we still play golf here? Hurling? Oh, there's a hand, went up at the back. Yeah, okay. It's a priest sort of thing, isn't it? You know, so the priest at the back, you know, brought that up. I gave this to a load of priests and all the hands went up. Okay, maybe we'll say hurling, okay? So, let's consider this, the essentially ordered series. Now, in this sort of series, the causes and effects are essentially related to each other. So, here's the mind moves the hands to move the golf club to move the ball. Okay, that's like mind, hand, stick, stone. Okay, so the golf player, there he is there, he moves his hands to move his golf club to hit the ball. That's what he does. Okay. The golf player, or his intentional agency, or however you want to parse that, that is the cause of the movement of the hands, which is the cause of the movement of the club, which is the cause of the movement of the ball. Were it not for the golf player's causal activity here, his hands wouldn't move, or they wouldn't move to do this. Or we could just imagine sitting trying to keep completely still and not moving his hands. The golf club definitely wouldn't move unless somebody else came and moved it. And the golf ball wouldn't move, okay? Because these things, they don't have motion in them, essentially. They're not like our fathers and sons who are able to beget, who are able to be fathers, given what they are, okay? Biologically functioning human beings. Golf clubs, balls, hands even, are inert, immobile, unless you have some sort of, you know, agent which moves them. So this is important. The causality of this series is not identical to the later members of the series. They have it extrinsically. They don't have it intrinsically. Whereas the causality in the accidentally ordered series is possessed intrinsically by the members of the series. So they don't need any help from anybody else to, you know, bring about their own effects. So if we think of the grandfather, father, and son, the father and son, or the father as a biologically functioning male, can bring about his own son. He can do, you know, what you do to bring about children. He doesn't need his father's help to do that. Okay, that would be weird. All right. He can do that himself, given what he is. But the golf club, the golf ball, the golf player's hands, they're not going to move without the agency of the golf player. All right. So what's the cause of the movement of the ball here? What causes the ball to move? Well, obviously the club does it. But what causes the club to move? Well, the hands do it. What causes the hands to move? Well, it's the agency of the golf player. All of them work together to produce the overall effect, which is the movement of the ball. The hands and the club, they are instruments or secondary causes of the mind or the agent, the golf player, who is the primary cause. His primacy is not in that he is first in the series, and these are sort of second, third, fourth, and fifth. It's that he has the causality of the series in himself as an agent. He is able to impart motion to the series, and that's what his primacy consists in. He originates the causality of the hands and the club. They are secondary or instrumental because they depend on the agency of the golf player. Okay, so that's what primary and secondary causality consists in. It's not these considerations of first and second. It's considerations of dependency. And something is primary insofar as it has the causality of the series intrinsically in itself as opposed to extrinsically from something else. And without all of these working together, the ball just wouldn't move. So we could imagine, it would be an awful situation, but a golf player on the golf course, he's swinging the ball, and then he's struck by lightning. Okay? That's the end of that. Okay? And the motion of that particular series is just going to stop, and some other motion, gravity or whatever, inertia, is going to come in and take its place. But the motion that that golf player is imparting to the series is gone as soon as he's struck by lightning, and, you know, he can no longer follow through. Okay, so let's just compare these two different kinds of series. This was the 13th century, by the way. St. Thomas came up with this, and he's basing it on considerations in Neoplatonic philosophy and Aristotelian philosophy, which, you know, came an awful lot earlier. So let's have a look at these. We have causes and effects. They're only accidentally related. The current members of the series do not need the earlier members in order to remain. So my grandfather, neither of my grandfathers are still alive. They don't need to exist now in order for me to exist. They don't need to be here in order for me to be here. Okay, so they can pass away, but I can remain. Okay, so the current members of the series don't need the earlier members. A grandson can still exist, even if his father and grandfather no longer exist, and that grandson can go on and have his own children, making his grandfather a great-grandfather and his father a grandfather. And we can remove these earlier members, but we can still have the later members. Take away the earlier members, you still get the later members. Nothing stops them acting as causes. Now I look at the per se, or the essentially ordered series. The causes and effects are essentially related to each other. They can't be, well, the effects at least can't be without these causes. Current members cannot be without the earlier members. Think of our golf example. The motion of the hands, the club, and the ball just wouldn't be unless the agency of the golf player were contributing that to them. The ball wouldn't move if the club and the hands are not moved by the mind of the golf player. So you can't remove that primary cause of the series, the agency of the golf player, without the series collapsing. That's what the lightning example illustrates, that you can't take away the agency of the golf player. He's hit by lightning and hope that, you know, that series will go on. We have a completely new causal series after that. We don't have the same sort of series that we had before. Whereas with the accidental series, you can take away the earlier members and it can continue. So they are essential differences between these two kinds of series. These are distinct kinds of causal series, yet they employ the same notion of causality, of derivation and dependency, of an effect on a cause. All right, so let's think about infinity. Infinite series. I've already hinted that, that accidental series, they can be infinite. Now, the infinite is what has no termination. It doesn't have a boundary. It doesn't have an edge. Here's the symbol for infinity here. You know, there's no start or end point. It's just continuous. There's no, you know, first, there's no last. It just goes on and on and on. Okay, so it's what has none of that. An infinite causal series, then, doesn't have a primary cause. So there's no primary cause to an infinite causal series. And so the immediate question that, you know, Thomas and Earl or medievals asked is, well, here, look, can either of our causal series be infinite? Can you have a causal series of that type without a primary cause? I've already suggested that in the accidental series, yes, you can. It's not necessary to have a primary cause of the accidental series, in which case it is possible for it to be without a primary. It may not, in fact, be without a primary, but it is certainly at least possible. There's nothing unintelligible about it. I'll leave the per se one until we get to it. So, these accidental series, precisely because one can remove earlier members and the series can continue, there is no need to have some sort of first or primary member of it. It can have a first, but there's no necessity for it. So you can go back and back and back and just keep having, you know, fathers of sons and fathers of sons and fathers of sons. As long as each member of that chain is accounted for, we have an explanation, a complete explanation of the existence of fathers and sons. So we don't need anything further than that. So it's possible for these sort of accidental series to be infinite. But when we look at these essential series, if the earlier members pass away, the later members pass away, or they lose their causality. So we go back to the golf example. If the golf player is struck by lightning, the hands, the club, and the ball, they all lose the motion that that agent has put into the series. Okay, so if he's struck by lightning and he dies, his hands are no longer moving through his agency. The club is no longer moving through his agency, nor is the ball moving through his agency. So you take away that member of the series, everything just collapses. You no longer have a causal series. So it has to be something primary in that sort of series which imparts the causality to the series, precisely because those later members of the series don't have that causality in themselves. They have it extrinsically. So what we say here, what the philosophers say here, is that in essential series, you need a cause for the causality of the series. not just a cause for the members, but a cause for the causality itself. And that which causes the causality of the series is what's primary. So the posterior members, because they don't possess the causality of the series in themselves, depend on what does possess the causality of the series in itself. And there's a number of different innocuous examples of this. So we've used the mind, hand, stick, and stone example. The other classic example that was always given was the fire heats the pot, to heat the contents of the pot. So the pot isn't self-heating. The contents of the pot isn't self-heating. But fire, simply in virtue of what it is, produces heat. Fire doesn't need help to produce heat. It ignites something, okay? And so it depends on what it ignites. But given what fire is, it doesn't need any help from anything else to produce heat. Whereas the pot and the contents of the pot do need something to produce the heat in them. So there's another example of this sort of essentially ordered series. We have those posterior members which don't possess the causality in themselves, i.e. ability to heat, and they do depend on something which does possess the causality in itself, which is the fire. Okay, and that's just an innocuous example of it. So these sort of series, they can't be infinite. There's some sort of primary cause there by which causality is imparted to the members of the series. And they're just everywhere, and they're just all interconnected. So the fire heats the pot, they heat the contents of the pot, but the fire is dependent itself on something else, not for heat, but for some other sort of causality. So to remain in existence, it needs, you know, something to burn. The golf player, the agent, he introduces motion to the hands, to the stick, and to the ball, or to the club, and to the ball. So he's primary with respect to that motion, that agency. But he's secondary in a different respect, because he needs to be brought into existence. He depends on an environment and the various physical laws of that environment and ultimately of the universe in order to be. So he's primary in respect of introducing motion to the series, but he's secondary in a different respect. All right. So these considerations then feed into the reasoning of the medievals for the existence of God. And what they do, and what Thomas specifically does, is he considers the very existence of things. He's very interested in things that exist. Okay, so he's very curious, but he's interested in the very existence of the things that do exist. So, we know that things exist, or at least in philosophy, if we're realists, we know that things exist. And these are some of the things that exist. So, hopefully we know what this is. This is the periodic table, okay? These are people. People exist. Planets exist. The solar system exists. Galaxies exist. So these are all things that exist. They don't have to exist. They need not have existed. In fact, these, and a lot of these didn't exist for an awful long while. Maybe helium might have existed, you know, right from very, very early. But the rest, you know, a lot of these and most of these just didn't exist for a good while. So they don't need to exist, but they do exist. Okay? So they don't essentially exist. Existence is not what they are. They don't have it essentially in themselves. In the same way that the stick and the golf ball, the club and the golf ball, don't essentially move. They don't have it in themselves, given what they are, to move. These sorts of things here, they don't have it in themselves to exist. All right? So they have existence from without. Technically speaking, essence and existence are distinct in these things. So it's not, their relationship to existence isn't like the relationship of our fathers and sons to paternity. They're able to beget children, given what they are, as biological males. Okay. These sorts of things here, given what they are, it's not the case that they exist, they just happen to exist. All right. If they were lacking existence, there'd be nothing. This is my sort of representation of nothing here. For some reason, it's always black. It's never white for some reason. I don't know why. I think maybe because you've got the colour spectrum with white. So I've portrayed it as black here. There would be absolutely nothing if these sorts of things were lacking in existence. If anything was lacking in existence at all, there would be nothing. So the things that do exist depend on their existence. Okay, every one of us would not be, or none of us would be, unless we had existence. So we depend on our existence. Okay, there is a dependency there for our existence. Okay. Much and all as we would love it, we will not always exist. Okay? We will die. Okay. Hopefully at this stage, you know, you've had that sort of existential crisis and, you know, you've worked your way through that and stuff. My daughter's 12 and kind of came to the realization of that she will die. But that's going to happen, all right? And we can lose existence. And we gained existence. Okay. Have I labored that point enough? Okay, right. If I need to again in the questions, I'll do so. So we're dependent for our existence. Existence is caused in us. So we have causality at work here. We have a causal series. I depend on my parents. I depend on the environment. The environment depends on the physical laws and those on even deeper physical laws and so on and so forth. The question is, then, is with regards to existence, okay, think of the causal feature of existence now. Before, when we were thinking of the golf player, we were thinking of motion. Now, we're thinking of existence as the causal feature. Is existence a causal feature which is located and explained within an accidental series or within an essentially ordered series? This is what Thomas is asking, and this is what he interrogates. This is what others interrogate as well. Is it located in one or the other? Which one is it in? Are things caused in their existence the way fathers and sons are caused in an accidental series? Do things have it in themselves to exist the way the father has it in himself to produce a son, and then they cause things to exist the way a father produces a son? Or is it more like the essential series? Are things caused in their existence the way the movement of the hands, the club and the ball is caused in that series? Okay. Would things naturally be lacking existence unless they had existence, in the way that the hands, club and the ball lack motion unless given motion? So how do we decide between the two of them? What do we do? Okay. The way to decide between an accidental and essential series is to consider whether or not the current members depend on earlier members so as to remain in the series. Do the later members essentially depend on the earlier members in order to be? In an essential series, you'll remember, we have grandfather, father, son. Does the son depend on the grandfather in order to exist? Well, we saw no, because the grandfather could be dead. The grandson isn't even born yet, and the father can grow up and produce his own son, the grandfather's grandson, but the grandfather's long since dead. So there is no essential dependency of the grandson on the grandfather. There's an accidental dependency. Grandfather produces the father, who produces the son, the grandson. That's an accidental dependency, but it's not an essential one. So if later members of the series don't depend on the earlier members of the series, we have an accidental series. But if later members of the series do depend on earlier members of the series, we have an essential series. And that's our hands, club and ball example. The hands, club and ball do, as later members of the series, depend on the agency of the golf player in order to have their motion. So that if you take away that agency, if you take away that agent, you don't have those later members of the series. So that's how we distinguish between the two series. And so we interrogate the existence of things. Is the existence of things like the grandfather, father and son, like paternity in that series? Or is it like motion in this series? Well, things don't essentially exist. We don't essentially exist. That's why I was sort of labouring that point that, you know, things come in and out of existence. We don't exist in virtue of what we are. I'm a human being, so I'm a rational animal. That's what I am. I am an animal whose form of animality is rationality. I'm not feline, okay? I'm not canine, I'm not equine. I'm human, so I'm rational. But there's nothing in that which says that I should exist. There are lots of animals which no longer exist, dinosaurs being one of them, okay? There are lots of those that just no longer exist. There is nothing in their essence or in their definition which stipulates that they need to exist. They just happen to. So we don't have it in ourselves, and all the other things that we look at don't have it in themselves to exist. That's not what their essences are. Fathers and sons do have it in themselves to go on and have more children, so long as they're, you know, biologically functioning. The causality of begetting or paternity or fatherhood or whatever is intrinsic to them. It's not extrinsic to them. Whereas existence is not intrinsic to us. It's not something that we have essentially given what we are. Rather, it's something extrinsic And given that it's extrinsic, it's caused in us, and we can lose it. So the existence of things, or existence relates to the things that exist, not in the way, not like the causality in the Fathers and Sons series, the accidental series, rather the existence of things and the causal relationship that attains amongst existing things is more like the essential series, or the per se series. And this is because the things that happen to exist are more like the hands, the club, and the ball. They don't have the causality of existence in themselves, or essentially, they have it from without. So, in the order of existence, when we consider the causality of existence, we're dealing with an essentially ordered, or per se ordered series, rather than an accidental series. Now, given what we've just seen about the accidental and essential series, the essentially ordered series needs some sort of primary cause, which doesn't have the causality of the series distinct from itself, but possesses it in itself. So we go back to our golf player. He's the agent. He has it in himself. He's just able to induce motion through his hands to the club and to the ball. He's able to do that. He has the causality of motion in himself. For whatever reason, he wants to go and hit balls about on the golf course. The fire, just given what it is intrinsically able to heat. It heats the pot, which heats the contents of the pot. So if existence is located in essentially ordered or per se ordered series, and it terminates in something primary, the primary cause then by which things which don't essentially exist have existence is something which does have it in itself to exist, i.e. something whose essence is its existence. Whereas the things that come and go in and out of existence have essence and existence as distinct components of themselves. So I have existence, but I'll lose it. And I have an essence, and my existence, you know, makes my essence real and exist. The cause of the existence of those things is something primary in which essence and existence are identical. In the same way that the agent who, you know, moves his hands to move the club, to move the ball, has motion or the ability to cause motion intrinsically to himself. So the primary cause for the existence of things then is something which is just pure existence. It doesn't have existence, and it doesn't just pass it along. It is pure existence itself. And as pure existence itself, it's able to originate existence. It doesn't take it from somewhere and pass it to something else. It originates it. Okay. And so when we arrive at some sort of primary cause, which is an originator of existence, this is what we understand God to be. If God's been understood to be anything, it's been this. That from which the existence of all things comes. But notice something peculiar here, that this notion of God, it's not something first, okay? It's not something prior to the Big Bang. It's not anything like that. Thomas has said that the accidental series can be infinite. It can be without a beginning. And there are lots of accidental series. So Thomas notoriously argued in the Middle Ages, and Stephen Hawking would have been done well to have read this before he wrote The Brief History of Time. See, St. Thomas argued that the universe can be infinite. That doesn't mean, okay, that doesn't mean that it is without a cause or without a creator. And this is precisely because it may be infinite with regard to, you know, all our various accidental series. But is it infinite and lacking independence with regard to existence? So if you imagine you just have, you know, this infinite universe, does it exist in virtue of what it is? Or are all its various components composites of essence and existence? The reason why I bring up Stephen Hawking there is that in his Brief History of Time, he pointed out that we can have a finite universe without a beginning, and if it's without a beginning, it doesn't need a cause. Okay? So if he had read his medieval metaphysics, he would realise there's been a bit of a problem there. He's reasoned, now let me just get the logic right. He's reasoned, if it has a beginning, it has a cause. It doesn't have a beginning, therefore it doesn't have a cause. That's known as the fallacy of denying the antecedent. Okay, that's his reasoning in A Brief History of Time. Now, the fallacy of denying the antecedent is, if you've got if P then Q, you can't reason from if P then Q to not P, therefore not Q. Here's another example. If I am a teacher, I'm a lecturer, if I'm a teacher, then I have a job. I'm not a teacher, therefore I don't have a job. Yeah, it doesn't follow. That's the logical fallacy. And that was Hawking's fallacy in A Brief History of Time. The medievals were well aware of that. They were well aware of that sort of fallacy. They realised that there are things which have a beginning and we can infer a cause for the things that have a beginning, but just because something has a cause doesn't mean that it needs to have a beginning. Okay? So the universe, so St. Thomas argued, can be this infinite sort of thing which is still dependent for existence. Existence is like the hook on which it needs to hang. Okay. So Thomas's considerations about God don't pertain to what caused the Big Bang or what was there before the Big Bang. Thomas is thinking more about the very existence of things. The very existence of things from the very beginning, if there was a beginning, to the very end, to right now. Anything that in any way exists, or did exist, or will ever exist, is dependent on this causal activity of God to bring it into existence. A very popular metaphor for this is the relationship of all things on this planet to the light of the sun. So all the different things on the planet are dispersed and arranged, you know, in various geographical regions and indeed temporal regions, but they all depend on the light of the sun in some sort of way. Now, the sun is just shining its light, just staying there, doing its thing, shining its light, whereas the various things here, going through all their different processes and motions and all their different regions, are depending on the light of the sun for their illumination. If there was no sun there, they would not be illuminated. Okay, there would be no illumination unless you had some sort of other, you know, light-giving, you know, star or whatever. So the sun's just there doing its thing, and then you have all these different geographical and temporal regions depending on that for their illumination. Well, the medievals, Thomas in particular, conceived of the relationship of creatures to God in the same sort of way. He's not there knocking over this row of cosmic dominoes. He's not there causing the Big Bang. He's there a bit like the sun, with everything in creation participating in the illumination of existence, such that creatures would not be unless they were illuminated by, you know, the existence which God causes. That then means that when it comes to considerations of evolution and such like, well, that's just like the various processes which go on the Earth under the illumination of the sun. So think about our secondary causes in the essentially ordered series. The hand, the club, and the ball. None of them would be moving or doing anything unless the golf player, as the agent, you know, caused them to move or do things. Now, the things that they do are proper to them. Hands have things that they do. They would be immobile, you know, without being moved by the agent, but there's a very specific thing that they do. Clubs, golf clubs, have things that they do. We hope that our use of golf clubs and hurley sticks and baseball bats are appropriate uses of them. That's the things that they do. We don't want any inappropriate uses of them, you know, for violent sort of activities or anything like that. And then, you know, golf balls have things that they do in the game of golf. Okay, so there are activities proper to those secondary causes, and the agent then, the golf player, simply, you know, gives them motion, allows them to act as the sort of causes that they are. In the same way that the sun illuminates everything in the earth, and we all go about our business on the earth, doing what we do under the illumination of the sun, and we are acting as secondary causes in that respect, so too does everything in creation go about its proper causality precisely because it exists and is able to exist as dependent on God. That then means that when we have these various evolutionary processes, the relationship of different living substances and producing new species of substances and so forth, that can all happen precisely because all the components of that actually exist. So there's no problem with that. Indeed, in my book on the metaphysics of creation, when we sort of get on to evolution, I point out that Thomas actually writes about new species developing out of old species. And he's got a very sophisticated account of how that's able to happen. So all those issues pertaining to evolution, I mean, I know it's, you know, very much in the public sphere and stuff, or at least it was when I was at university about 10 or 15 years ago. All these sort of issues about evolution and God and stuff, it's not really an issue for Thomas. Well, first of all, because he was unaware of evolution, but secondarily, because given his whole account of the relationship of creatures to God, it was no threat to how he thought about God and creation. Might be a threat to somebody without this sort of framework, but it's not a threat to him. Okay. Now, that sort of went more towards the sort of the Big Bang and the evolution sort of thing. I want to kind of finish up by taking it in a different direction. So I went, you know, more toward in towards the scientific realm and how, you know, philosophy can illuminate issues that science, you know, brings up for this. But I want to go more towards the theological realm as well, because I know there's some people interested in theology here as well. I want to finish with this. So we have this notion of a primary cause whose essence is existence, pure existence itself, and this is what God is understood to be. And, you know, we've just kind of scratched the surface of, you know, this reasoning. Anybody wants to go deeper, you know, 2015, Oxford University Press, Aquinas' Way to God, if you'd like. Should be in your library. All good, libraries help. Right. So we've gotten into this philosophical reasoning. Now, look at the book of Exodus, if anybody is interested in Scripture. In the book of Exodus, right, we are presented with a conception of God which is more or less the same one that Thomas has arrived at by means of pure philosophy. So he hasn't used any scripture. He hasn't used any sort of theological reasoning or reasoning based on faith or revelation. He's used just these considerations of causality, per se, practice, or series, and the whole philosophical tradition behind him. The author of Exodus didn't use that. He wasn't a metaphysician. He wasn't a philosopher. But he comes up with the same sort of conception of God that Thomas, you know, a few millennia later, came up with using the sort of the best sort of philosophical reason. At least I submit it's the best sort of philosophical reasoning. Okay? So the author of the book of Exodus, we have Moses there, you know, he's speaking to the burning bush, and he asks God what is his name, and God says, you know, I am who I am. Okay, this is a very classic sort of name of God, Yahweh. I am who I am. God is he who is. Okay? Now, he who is, not a lion or a tiger or some sort of individual thing, although, you know, we get those sorts of, depictions of God, you know, mighty warrior, you know, counselor, all of that. But when God gives us his name, when God gives us his identity, in Exodus, well, according to the author of the book of Exodus, he gives it as he who is. There is no known historical antecedent to that in the ancient world. Okay, there is no known historical antecedent to that. That seems to be unique to the author of the book of Exodus. So here's the query. I sort of end, you know, towards the end of my 2015 book, I kind of raise this sort of, you know, enticing sort of query. Is it a coincidence that the author of the book of Exodus, with no philosophical reasoning or engagement, gives us the same account of God that the best philosophy can give us a few millennia later? Is that a coincidence, or do we need to be open to the possibility that in some sort of way the author of the book of Exodus had a revelation that this is what God is, pure existence itself, he who is? So I'm just going to leave you with that, okay? I'm happy enough to take any questions.
So the quick question is, it's not about the truth of what you're saying, it's about the justification in believing it, right?
Mm.
So if you're someone who really likes philosophy, and spoilers, I do, you're going to look at a lot of this stuff, and you're going to go through the arguments, and you're going to see what's true, right? You're going to be able to follow it and assess for yourself what the arguments are. If you're someone who doesn't know the philosophy at a pretty high level of depth, you're going to say, okay, well, Gavin Kerr is saying this, Graham Offey is saying this, here's a good atheist, here's a good theist. If you yourself can't follow the argument all the way to the end of quite several levels of responses to responses, can you be justified in taking a side on that question, and what would justify you? In other words, if you can't necessarily follow the argument yourself, what justifies you in saying, I think that guy's right rather than that guy?
Yeah. I think the baseline is that if you can't follow a particular argument which is going on, then you need to refrain from adjudicating on that argument. So, let's say about 15 years ago, I first read Heidegger. Not a clue, not a notion. I read Being and Time, just did not get it. Took me about 10 years to understand it. In those 10 years, I just refrained from forming an opinion or a view about Heidegger. Or if I had an opinion or a view about him, it wasn't philosophically justified. It might have been based on something else. Now, ideally, what we want is some sort of, if we're dealing with matters in philosophy, we want some sort of good philosophical justification, which means following the arguments, getting the appropriate conclusions, and if we can do that, then we could take a side. But I would really advise somebody, if they cannot follow the arguments, say, against me or somebody else, or St. Thomas or somebody else, not comparing myself to Thomas at all, but, you know, between two philosophers, that they should refrain from taking sides in those sorts of debates.
So should somebody not believe in God then, if they don't have that level of communication? Mm-hmm.
Well, as I said, so with Heidegger, I formed an opinion, a non-philosophical opinion about Heidegger on the non-philosophical sort of aspects of him from different sources. So, you know, his membership of the Nazi party, his very good treatment of his Jewish students, supposedly the reports of his good treatment of the Jewish students, and I sort of formed an overall opinion of him in that respect, because I was able to kind of follow what was going on there. But when it came to these various issues in philosophy, I didn't form a view on the matter. And so I think, with regard to the existence of God, I think you can give a pretty tight demonstration, which is defensible, of the existence of God, and you would be justified philosophically in holding it. But one can, say, assent, say that they believe in the existence of God, but you wouldn't have philosophical justification for it. All right. Yeah, go on.
If you could just somewhat over there, just the, you talked about essence and existence, and you said that basically something kind of, did you say something could have essence but not exist, or was it the other way around?
No, they definitely can't have an essence but not exist, because if something doesn't exist, it's just, it's nothing. Yeah.
So can you just go over the difference between those two things?
Okay. So the essence of a thing is what it is, okay? So it's definitional content, okay? So what exactly it is. So I'm a rational animal, okay? That's the kind of thing I am. I'm not a feline animal, okay? And I'm not a canine animal. So that's what my essence is. But my existence isn't rational animality, okay? It's something distinct from that, which causes me as a rational animal to be in the world. And when I lose it, then this rational animal will no longer be in the world. That's the distinction between the two of them.
Okay.
So how's that?
Yeah.
Father Connor, you had your hand up at the back, yeah.
First of all, thanks very much for your presentation. It's great to get an affirmative response to this question of the existence of God. It's good for my job security.
Okay.
But my question is, well, other kinds of arguments of the existence of God that are... probably a lot more popular than this. I'm thinking of somebody like William A. Craig, who bases his argument on the question of the beginning of the universe. So he says, the universe has a beginning, but has a beginning, must have a cause, therefore the universe must have a cause outside of itself.
Yeah.
So the Kalam cosmological argument, as it's called, it's simpler, and it's kind of, yeah, it's more sellable. So do you think it's worth focusing on that kind of argument? Or do you focus on this more complicated, even if it's more finessed argument?
Yeah, I think... First of all, with regard to Kalam arguments, I think the dependence of those tracks the truth of certain conclusions in other non-philosophical disciplines. I think the question of the existence of things is a question for metaphysics, that domain of philosophy which considers the being or the reality of things, that asks what is real, are substance and substance relations, are they real? Okay, so I think the existence of things pertains to that. And so we need a metaphysical argument, one which considers that which all beings possess and share in common, substance, accident, causality, relation. I think those other sorts of arguments, like the Kalam argument or like the design argument, track conclusions outside of metaphysics. And so they're as strong as those conclusions, and they presuppose the existence of things. They're not treating of the very being of things. Whereas this sort of argument here, it's not interfering with a domain improper to itself. It's dealing with metaphysics and only with metaphysics. It's not trying to do science, and it's not trying to do psychology or anything like that. It's not trying to do history. It's just simply trying to, you know, consider what's real and what's the constitution of reality. So whilst it's much more complicated and much more difficult, I think it's the only way to sort of go with these sorts of arguments, because I think the others are just as strong as the premises that they presuppose from other disciplines. So it's more than just a strategic decision. It's a matter of truth, I think. Yeah. But saying that, you know, William Lane Craig, he's a very able thinker. You have a question here? Yeah.
So you said that the universe, there is no beginning as such.
It's possible, yeah.
And in that case, with time and space, is there a beginning or there's no beginning?
Way back in ancient philosophy, in Aristotle, there's this, you know, very strong account that time is without a beginning. And if you take time and space, you know, to be intrinsically linked realities, then time and space could be without a beginning. If they are elements within, you know, that sort of series of causes. If there's no necessity for them to have a beginning, then there's no need for a beginning. They may just happen to have one, but there's no necessity for it.
And with regards to the illusion aspect, so why does that say, you're saying that the point says that there is, you can have new species coming from other species.
Yeah.
And how does he actually justify that?
Okay, yeah. So he's very explicit about that. He literally says that. So in my book, I have the passage, Latin and in English, you know, translated. So the way in which Thomas deals with that, Thomas takes things that exist to be substances. Okay, so we'll not get into too much depth about, you know, the sort of constitution of substances, but substances are just basic things that exist. I'm a substance, rocks are substances, cats are substances, and substances have what are called accidents. Now, accidents can change, okay? I'm 6'1", I weigh about 74 kilograms. Say 20 years ago, I wasn't the same height, I definitely wasn't the same weight, okay? Those are accidental features of me. They're actually quantitative. They're quantitative accidents. They're differences in quantity. The substance remains the same, but the accidents can change. So that's how things are constituted, according to Aquinas. Now, they can enter into all sorts of relationship with things, okay? So, for instance, I'm taking my son to the barber on Saturday. He's going to get his hair cut. So, some of his accidents are going to change. He's still going to be the same thing that he is. Now, his accidents are going to change because he enters into a relationship with the barber. The barber does something to him, and something happens to him. Think about evolution now. Okay, we have substances, and they have various sorts of accidents. Okay, great, grand. Now, given what the substances are, they have certain accidents which are generated from them. Given that I'm a rational animal, I am able to laugh. I am able to take a joke and I am able to laugh. Non-rational things can't do that because they can't understand the joke, the irony, or whatever, they just don't get it. So risibility, the ability to laugh, is an accident which is proper to me as a rational animal. Purring is an accident which is proper to cats. Barking, let's say, is an accident proper to dogs, and so on and so forth. So we have all these proper accidents which the substances have. They live in an environment, and some of those proper accidents allow them to thrive within that environment. Now, let's say we have a certain kind of substance and it lives in environment A. And let's say one of those substances comes about and just by some sort of, you know, accidental mutation, given the, you know, the material constitution of things, some mutation occurs and it has some sort of extra accident. So we'll have plus one here, just adding some sort of extra accident. It has some sort of feature. It is still the same kind of substance, but now has this extra accidental feature to it as well. Now, let's say that extra accidental feature allows it to thrive in environment B. So let's say this substance here can not only thrive in environment A, but can also thrive in environment B. And let's say that it meets a substance in environment B that has, you know, various accidents, but it has these accidents, and this new substance is able to reproduce with this sort of substance, well, then it will start to have offspring that are, you know, the sort of substances here, the mixture of the two, with this extra accident, but not as something extra, but as a feature flowing from what they are, like purring in cats or barking in dogs. So Thomas holds that once you get, you know, these various sorts of accidents, which can kind of come about as random mutation, and allow one to thrive in a different sort of environment, and once reproducibility occurs there, then you start to get the emergence of new species, new types of things, and down the line, through the years, eventually you get sorts of things which can only thrive in this environment and can no longer thrive in this environment. So you have new specification there. That's a general framework.
But doesn't the substance remain the same in that case? Doesn't the substance still remain the same?
When you get to the point where the substance in question has this sort of added extra accident, not as something kind of extrinsic which just added to it, but which is part and parcel of it being the kind of substance that it is, you have a new sort of substance. So, for instance, I used purring as an example. Let's say, you know, some sort of dog is born which is able to purr, okay? And then it moves into a new environment and starts reproducing with animals there, and now you're having these doggy-like animals which purr. You're starting to see a new species which are able to purr just simply given what they are. So you have a new particular kind of substance in that case. So that's how a Thomist would account for it. Obviously, Thomas is unaware of evolution, but that's how a Thomist would do it. So, yeah.
Looking at your observations on Thomas Aquinas, what he has achieved towards Christian theology using the philosophical track, and to make some of these, if I can say, not assumptions, but philosophical conclusions about cause and effect in the existence of God. When we use it now, especially within the Western culture, is that there's always a presiding risk that through the signs of the ages or the zeitgeist that we have now is that there is a potential in that when you track the arguments of Thomas Aquinas, Alvin Plantinga, William Craig, and all of these guys, there's a leaning towards even though they're trying to reach out maybe even to the millennials about the resurgence of the belief in God, there's always that risk that within their own arguments, they will lead the ones that they're trying to convince into a more rationalist thinking and a more presiding danger of them actually moving away from their arguments and being convinced by the arguments of the likes of Dawkins and all of that.
Yeah.
And so just that danger in using Aquinas in how he uses this philosophical approach. So with that in mind, and with the age that we're living in now, it brings me to the thought of coming back to the Bible stories themselves, the poeticism that is found in them, and the use of guys like Carl Jung, Eric Neumann, and all of those guys in bringing out what the essential biblical doctrines were in there, and how that affects Western culture. And just like Friedrich Nietzsche predicted that once you remove this idea of God from a certain society, then there is a sort of like a push towards this. Now we have to assume the position of God and create our own ideals and such things like that.
Yeah.
And so just tracking that argument and saying that maybe within our times now is maybe the arguments of Thomas Aquinas, William Craig, and Alvin Plantinga, and these guys, not as effectual as the arguments of, you would say, maybe the psychoanalysts like Carl Jung and all of those guys who actually are speaking into a deeper sense of why we hold to these presuppositions of Christian beliefs and traditions, and without them, that the system would actually fall apart.
Okay, so, I would want to distinguish between apologetics and philosophy. So when we do philosophy, we're trying to get at the truth of the matter. So it's just a question of truth and falsehood here. So when you get somebody like Plantinga, let's say, he's got that big, well, not big book, but he's got that book, The Nature of Necessity. And he just goes through, modal semantics, modal metaphysics, and he comes up with some very interesting things about essentialism, and then that feeds into, some of his other thinking. You have Thomas here. He's looking at essence, existence, and causality. He's doing dry, hard, boring philosophy. It's not exciting. There's nothing exciting about it. Philosophers are a weird bunch. They get excited. They need locked up when, because they're into this sort of stuff. But they're just trying to consider the truth or falsity of the matter. They're not doing apologetics when they're doing philosophy. If they're going to do apologetics, or if they're going to preach, they have a particular goal that they want to achieve, and then they'll make use of whatever resources they can to achieve that goal. But that might coincide sometimes with philosophy, but that's not philosophy. Philosophy is trying to get to the truth of the matter. Okay? So when we go through, say, St. Thomas's arguments, like this, what we're doing is philosophy. We're trying to get to the truth of the matter over whether or not God exists. But when we try to do apologetics, we try to convince somebody of the existence of God, or of the value of religion, or of the value of a particular religious tradition that, you know, this conception of God inspires. And if that's what we're doing, well, you know, we can make use of Nietzschean sort of reasoning. We can make use of Jungian sort of archaeologies of the biblical stories. We can do that whole thing that Jordan Peterson does and have the various archetypes and do the whole, you know, sort of biblical lectures and, you know, tease out the archetypes and the different biblical stories. That's fine. But that's not doing philosophy. That's not assessing what the truth of the matter is. So it's just a division of our particular task and what we're up to. And so when we do philosophy, all we're doing is considering truth or falsity. Whether or not it speaks to a person, well, I mean, that's up to the person to decide. If something is true and it doesn't speak to the person, well, I mean, does that person value truth then? And that's a different issue.
But philosophy doesn't, I mean, even though it does encapsulate truth, then they need to know oneself and understand the universe. There's other approaches as well. It doesn't mean that they don't like any truth in them, too.
Well, that's certainly the case. I mean, philosophers, you know, they disagree. If there's any sort of a priori in philosophy, it's that philosophers disagree. It doesn't mean there isn't the truth of the matter. And it doesn't mean that there's not a discussion to be had there to see which position is true. So how does that sit? Yeah, I see your hand. Do you want to come back at it, or can we go to the last question and then maybe you might want to come back?
Okay, chat about it later.
Okay, yeah.
So, a quick question to find it.
Yeah.
You said, in the very beginning of the lecture, on the slide, maybe the second slide, you said there's a definite proof of existence of God.
Yeah.
So it's like pure logic could reach the existence of God. Is it?
Logic is certainly involved, but it's not pure logic in the technical sense. Because if you think of logic, if you think of soldiers marching on the spot, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what logic does, but it doesn't go anywhere. Okay, soldiers need somebody to direct them. So you need to feed something into that logic machine to generate conclusions about the world. So there is logic and there is various premises about reality.
And that's why the philosophers not having proof of the existence of God, because they do not have the additional premises.
They do have proof of it. Well,
I mean, other atheists.
Right. It depends which atheists you're talking about. So there are atheists who would engage with this and other arguments, and they might see problems with the premises, or they might see problems with the logic. And that's not just restricted to this sort of domain. That's, you know, kind of in all branches of philosophy.
So,
you get.
Sorry. So with these premises not being logical,
well, what do you mean by premises?
Those aspects that you add on to the logic to reach into the existence of God.
I don't think it would be right to say that they're illogical. They certainly fit in with the logical machinery, so they're consistent with the logic of the argument. There's nothing illogical or irrational about the premises.
Yes, but I mean, there are some atheists, I mean, philosophers, say there is no God.
Yes. Yeah.
So would they be logical as well?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And then the disagreement comes, you know, over where we think some part of the argument is logically follows or doesn't logically follow. So, and there are a lot of different systems of logic which are in use, and a lot of arguments have embedded premises or hidden premises, or they make hidden assumptions, which it takes, you know, an interlocutor to kind of help unearth. Yeah. How does that sit with you? Okay.
Right.
Yeah, go on.
Talking about immutability to make decisions. I was wondering, how does our free will compare to God's, and if God can't sin, does he really have free will?
Okay, so the ability to make decisions, how does our will compare to God's will? And if God can't sin, does he really have the ability to make, does he have free will? Wonderful! Right. Okay. Can I use the board here for this?
Yep.
Right. Okay. Right. Okay. Very quickly. So we have God as pure existence. Okay. Now, we didn't get onto this in the actual lecture, but if we think about God as pure existence itself, we are able to affirm that what is pure existence itself, i.e. that whose essence is its existence, has both an intellect and a will. Do you want me to go through the demonstration of that, or will I just get straight on to the question of the will?
I don't mind.
Okay.
Do.
Right, okay. Right. Alright. To be able to understand something, to have an intellect, to understand something, is to have the forms of things distinct from oneself, within oneself, without becoming those things. Now, I'm going to use an example, but it's to have the forms of things distinct from oneself, within oneself, without becoming those things. Take a tree, alright? We can take a tree, we can cut it down, and we can make a desk out of it, okay? That tree had the form of a tree, but then when it is given the form of a desk, it's no longer a tree. All right. Humans can have the forms of things distinct from themselves, in themselves, but they don't become those things. I have the form of this desk in me because I'm thinking about it. I have the form of all you in me because I'm thinking about you. Okay? So we have the forms of things distinct from ourselves, in ourselves, without becoming them. And that's because we have an intellect. That's what it is to have an intellect. Okay? That's called the intentional or the intellectual possession of form. Whereas the wood of the tree doesn't have that. It takes on the form of the table, ceases to be a tree. Now, is that the case for what's pure existence itself? Right. We have pure existence itself. Everything exists because it depends on it in some sort of way. So we've got all these little creatures here, okay? And they all exist because they depend on this. Outside of pure existence, there's nothing, okay? There simply is pure existence, outside of which there is nothing which does not depend on it. So all the forms of existence, I'd say these are humans, cats, demons. See the demons right beside the cats there? That's okay, right? Okay. All these different forms of existence are forms of existence. So all these forms of things that exist are here primordially, or fundamentally, or primarily. God has all forms of things distinct from himself, in himself, but he's not any one of these things. Now we just said, okay, we just observed, that what is able to have the forms of things distinct from itself, in itself, without becoming those things, is something which is intelligent, it thinks it has an intellect. So pure existence itself, in virtue of being pure existence itself, has an intellect. Now how do we get the will? The will is the intellectual desire for what is good. Okay? It's an intellectual desire for something that is good. So I take it a lot of you are going to have pizza today. Okay. How many of you's nectar of the gods coffee? Yeah. I'm a teetotaler, so this is my thing. All right. So this is my 8th cup today. You know, it's rookie number, sorry. We see something and we think, yes, coffee. I'll be having that. And, you know, we desire it. That's what the will is. It's this intellectual apprehension and desire for what is good. Pure existence itself. What does God have to think about? Okay, he's God, just existing there away in eternity, you know. He's not dependent on things outside himself for his knowledge. He's got all the forms of things that could possibly exist in himself. So what does God think about? He thinks about himself. Okay, that's what God thinks about when he thinks. He's thinking about himself, and then thinking about himself, he thinks about the things that he's able to create and does create. Now, things would be radically incomplete, okay, all these creatures here, they would be lacking in some very important way if they did not have existence. If I didn't exist, I would seriously be lacking in something. Alright? So, when we lack in something, we don't have something that is actual. Okay? Something that is real. The foundation of reality is existence. So that when we lack something, it's something real and existing that we're lacking. Or something which we at least perceive, if we're intellectual, to be real and existing. So existence is the basis for the fulfillment of those things that we lack. Now, to lack something is to be in a certain way imperfect or incomplete in relation to what we lack. So, I need food. I am lacking in food. It's been since lunchtime that I ate today. So I'm lacking in food in some sort of way. So I'm deficient or imperfect in a certain way unless I'm completed by food. That's just a fact. Okay, so food perfects me in a way. It is a good for me, something that completes me, something which actualizes me. But existence is the very foundation and principle of actuality. Nothing is actual without existence. So if what is good is what completes or actualizes me in some way, then existence, which is the very principle of actuality, must be the good itself. But God is pure existence. And if existence is the good itself, and God is pure existence, then God is the pure good itself. What is the will? It's the intellectual apprehension of something as good and thereby desired. What does God think about with his intellect? He thinks about himself as pure existence, which is pure goodness, in which case he apprehends pure goodness itself and desires nothing but the good in and of itself. So God has a will. Okay, so that's in a nutshell the arguments, you know, for intellect and will. It takes about 2 or 3 weeks lecture-wise to go through those, but that's it. All right, now, the question of God's will and our will. Okay, we have a will, and let's say, so here's our human here, and we have a will, and our will is free precisely because it's not constrained. There is nothing which constrains our will. So, ordinarily, I would be like, you know, should I do A or should I do B? Should I go back to Maynooth tonight, you know, get tucked up in bed and get up early and go back home to Belfast tomorrow? Or should I go out drinking with you guys, you know, break my teetotaler, you know, sort of pledge and all that and go out drinking? Okay, I'm free to do either. I'm not constrained. Now, if my colleague Philip over there beats me up and says, no, you're coming back to my news with me, Gavin, you're not doing it. I'm not going to let you. Okay? So you have to do that. I'm no longer free.
You.
So, you know, I'm afraid of this guy. Okay? So, I'm no longer free. I don't have free will. So freedom of the will consists in freedom from constraint. God is unable to sin. Why is God unable to sin? Because God can will nothing but the good. But look at this. There is God's willing nothing but the good consists in his being pure existence itself. There is nothing outside of him which to which he is subject or which constrains him. Everything that exists is dependent on him. He is dependent on nothing because there's nothing other than him. So there's nothing which constrains him. If freedom of the will is freedom from constraint, then God is ultimately free because he can do whatever he wants. And whatever he wants to do is pure goodness itself. We are free whenever we can do whatever we want. Go to my nose or go out drinking. Okay. But ironically, sometimes when we choose what we want to do, we choose it because we think this would be a good thing. Ironically, sometimes when we choose to do that, we lose our freedom. We end up becoming constrained by choosing what we want to do. So some of our free choices end up undermining our freedom. So for example, if I'm a recovering alcoholic and I don't take Philip's advice, he knows I'm a martial arts enthusiast, so he's not going to beat me up, and I go out drinking with you guys, we start off a pattern there where my freedom will be constrained because I will thus, you know, fall off the wagon, become dependent on alcohol, and my will then will be ruled by an addiction to alcohol, rather than a rational exercise in, you know, pursuit of what is good. Okay, but so short answer to your question, God's inability to sin doesn't mark a constraint upon his will. God's inability to sin lies in the fact that he can do whatever he wants, and what he wants is the good itself. And that's the same for the saints. So the saints are in heaven, they're unable to sin, and so they're ultimately free. They're not imprisoned in some, you know, the choices like falling off the wagon, you know, of alcohol or whatever like that. They're fully free because they don't have sort of any desires to do anything which would be bad for them. They only desire what is good. Okay. Does that address your question at least?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
All right, so let's give him another round of applause.